You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 28th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder. Hold on. You're not up, buddy. You have to press that button over there. It's okay. It's okay.
I'm Michael Brooks.
There we go. And this is the three-time award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal, but not metaphorical. Wait, no longer in the literal, never in the metaphorical shadow.
You're good.
Of the New York Times building, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In the heart of America.
I combined both the old and new intro in that one.
Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Sam could not be here because of another engagement. That's right. Sam is having another colonoscopy just for his own entertainment.
He liked it.
Yeah, he liked it so much he needed it twice. Just kidding. Sam, though, does have a prior engagement, but we have a great pre-recorded interview with Ed Pilkington of The Guardian.
Sam conducted.
That's Sam conducted.
So you will be getting your Sam Steeder fix today.
You'll be getting your Sam Steeder fix today, as Matt says. It's a really disturbing interview on how the FBI, this unbelievable case of the FBI using entrapment, basically, to target radical environmental activists. You'll definitely want to hear this interview. Then Matt and I are going to take you through the fun half and take your calls, take your IMs. Got some stories from Mexico, Saudi Arabia, and Matt has really just a Fox News opus is the only way I could describe it.
It's a great way to put it. An opus of Fox,
An opus of Fox. It's going to be great. Stay with us. We will be right back with Sam's interview with Ed Pilkington.
But before we go to that, we need to tell you something. We need you to nominate us for the Podcast Awards at podcastawards.com. You simply go to podcastawards.com in your web browser of choice. You go to the People's Choice and then also the Politics/News categories, and you simply type out The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. You do that, you put in your name, your email, and you press submit.
And I think, don't you also have to put in a link to our website
or URL? Majority.fm. Yeah. It
looks complicated, but it's really simple.
When you go to the site, you'll see it. It's easy peasy. We've already won three straight Politics/News podcast awards. That's 3 years in a row because all of you guys were able to do this previously for us.
And let's just say really quick while we do it so we can go right into the fun half. Become a member today. That's the way this show stays alive and grows. You know all the ways that you can support this show. Buy crap through our Amazon link. We get a cut. Just Coffee, all the rest. I'll keep it short. You know what the deal is. Become a member. We'll be right back with Sam's interview with Ed Pilkington. And then Matt and I are going to take you into the fun half. Members.
We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the chief reporter of Guardian US. He is New York-based, Ed Pilkington. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, Ed, this was a piece that you reported on now. I guess it's going back 2 weeks, and it involves at the time, a fairly young man of 25 years old, Eric McDavid, who was sentenced to 19 years in federal prison because of, well, I mean, you tell us. He was reportedly, according to the U.S. government, a member of the ELF, the Earth Liberation Front. Tell us about the Earth Liberation Front.
Yeah, this was at a time when there was a lot of sort of moral panic around sort of more radical environmental groups, including the ELF. It was 9/11. It was sort of the sort of concern that you now have around Muslim communities was then being given to the more radical environmentalist groups, who were sort of aligned to anarchist groups and what would nowadays be called the Occupy movement, though that, of course, didn't exist at the time. And Eric McDavid was active in those circles. They would participate in protests happening at sort of G8 meetings of, you know, the industrialized world leaders. They would meet at outside trade meetings and protest about them. They protested very heavily about concern around climate change and wanting something to be done to combat that. And in this sort of rather fringe network of sort of splinter groups all interconnected, into that was inserted by the FBI a very sort of unusual and peculiar informant, and that was what my story was about.
And I should remind people that I guess it was now, maybe 3 years ago, we spoke to Marshall Curry, who was a filmmaker who documented in his movie If a Tree Falls the story of the Earth Liberation Front, and particularly zeroing in on someone who was prosecuted and sent to jail at that time, a guy named Daniel McGowan, who actually he was prosecuted and apprehended long after he had been out of the ELF. And so there's a lot of, particularly also following 9/11, a lot of FBI involvement with prosecuting and hunting for terrorists wherever they could find them. And this seems like it's one of those cases. So tell us what, after serving 9 of those 19 years, Eric McDavid has been released. So what did it have to do with this? So informant, I guess it depends on what your perspective as an informant is.
Well, I don't think in this case there was any doubt about the person's role as an informant. Let me tell you about her. Her given name in these circles, her pseudonym that she adopted was Anna. She was 18 at the time, and she went underground quite consciously. She began going underground as part of a night course she was doing in Miami. And to impress her professor, she went and infiltrated a group of protesters that happened to be meeting in Miami at that time. And one of the members of her class was a law enforcement officer, and he passed her on to the FBI, and they quickly adopted her, thinking, well, this could be a really amazing asset.
Well, that's
so
what
they
I mean
sent her into these groups.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean by it's dubious to call her an informant, right? Because I think most people, at least in the lay people, presume that informant is someone who has been part of an enterprise and at one point decides they don't want to be part of that anymore, or that what's going on is wrong, and so they inform on what they've been doing and what the others are doing. But she's basically sent in there as, I mean, it seems to me, and maybe that's what the court has found, there is as a provocateur.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Sam, and you're correctly picking me up on that. Maybe a better word would be infiltrator. Infiltrator or agent provocateur. I mean, and that's where this story gets really interesting. I mean, because if you look at those two words, infiltrator means someone who infiltrates a group. It implies a certain neutrality in what they then do. Agent provocateur means that they go in, infiltrate a group, and then they actively sort of stir up trouble of some sort or another. And this is where the legal argument lies in this case.
Yeah, so, I mean, give us tell us essentially the story, because it involves not just McDavid, but two other of McDavid's cohorts at the time. I think one of whom, the most amount of time that the other two spent, I believe, was 6 months of jail time. But tell us, a bit, walk us through that story.
Yes, well, Anna was sent into this fringe network that I talked about of splinter groups on the radical eco movement. During those meetings, she came across these three people, Eric McDavid and two of his friends, and she befriended all of them. She adopted a costume to make herself look like them. She dyed her hair pink, and she started wearing sort of camouflage uniform to kind of merge in. And she befriended them to an extent that lawyers for the three individuals think overstepped the mark. It was no longer the neutrality of the infiltrator. It became the agent provocateur because she befriended them, and by doing so, she lured them into doing acts that their lawyers say they would never normally have considered on their own. And in particularly with Eric McDavid, new documents that have just come to light, which is what my piece was based upon, suggest that she encouraged him romantically and that she led him to believe that if he participated in extremist violent acts, that some lawyers suggest that she actively participated in and created herself, then if he participated with those, that there would be hope of a relationship, a sexual relationship with her later. And therefore, the legal argument was that Eric McDavid was lured, was sort of drawn into an area of violent action that he would not normally have taken on his own.
All right. Well, there's two things that struck me in your piece. One is this notion of that McDavid's attorney was attempting to prove this at the time, and was unable to at the time. And I want to get to that in a moment. But there was also a sense that this Anna, who seemed to be this sort of like, I don't know, I guess a hobbyist infiltrator, right? As the way that it
right, because, that's a good way of putting it.
Because she neither, I guess, explicitly worked for the FBI. It just seems like she was going to school and decided this is what she wanted her calling to be. Almost
that's
like
right.
like an overzealous neighborhood watch person in some way. That she claims that she was very sensitive about following certain guidelines. Give me a sense of what those guidelines are. In other words, you know, where, how explicit under, you know, the, I guess, FBI's operations, and I don't know who sets these guidelines, whether it's prosecutors or what, but like, what are those guidelines? I mean, when has a supposed infiltrator or supposed informant crossed the line, and whose line is that?
Well, it's a very clear legal line. It's actually set down in law that there are guidelines on the FBI's use of informants / infiltrators. You know, if you look at the small print, it goes on forever. But to boil it down to one single argument, infiltrators are not allowed to lead. And that's it in a nutshell. They're not allowed to infiltrate a group. And once they get into that group, pretending to be a member of the group, they are not allowed to then sit around and say, hey, guys, why don't we go blow up a dam? Which is what one of the acts that were planned among this small group of people, which landed Eric McDavid in prison for best part of 29 years he was originally sentenced for.
And so,
they are not allowed to lead. And the whole legal argument was, did Anna lead the other three into doing things that they wouldn't have done themselves? Now, at the trial, as you rightly say, McDavid's then trial lawyer tried very hard to make the argument, because he, of course, had been talking to McDavid, and McDavid had told him, look, she led me to believe that we would have a relationship if I went along with her plans. So he knew what the argument was made by McDavid, but he lacked the evidence to make the case. It took another many years until, the end of last year, that the prosecution admitted that they had documents, they had an email trail that they hadn't given to the defense at the time of trial, which of course is illegal, because under constitutional law, the prosecution must disclose to the defense any exculpatory materials that could help the defense prove the innocence of the defendant.
Yeah, I want to return to that, because the outrage expressed not just by the defense in this situation, but the judge presiding over this. I mean, he was amazed by this as to what materials was withheld. But just to give a sense of just how much, I guess, sort of control over the situation the FBI had, outline for us the there was a road trip that Anna took with at least a couple of these folks. The other two, I think, supposed co-conspirators were Zachary Jensen and Lauren Weiner, both of whom, like I say, they accepted plea bargains at the time and testified against McDavid. They served anywhere, I think, from 2 weeks to 6 months, if I'm correct on that. But what's also sort of like stunning about it is that the FBI was in control of all of this, vehicles, cabins, documenting everything. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, the plan, and it should be stressed, I think, at this point, that we don't know the full story. And we don't know the full story because the government is still not releasing to lawyers and to the public the vast majority of the documents they've admitted they have in this case. So we don't really know the full details of who said what to whom when, and who came up with what idea at what which point. But the headlines are certainly very suggestive, and that is that the group, with Anna at its center, came up with a plan to carry out various violent acts related to eco causes, and they were going to do that on the West Coast. Now, Anna got hold of a car, which the FBI had bought for her. She drove that car, she picked up Lauren and the other guy, and she drove them across the country. Then she picked up Eric McDavid and drove up north to a cabin in the north of California, a cabin rented by the FBI on her behalf. Both the car and the cabin were entirely rigged. They were full of bugging devices so that the FBI could listen into everything. Funnily enough, we haven't heard those tapes. Most of those tapes have still not been released to the public. So we don't know what was said in the car, and we don't know what was said in the cabin. And having done all that, she then presented the other three with a book of recipes for how to make bombs. Now, those recipes came from her. The FBI, in the prosecution case, said that those recipes have been carefully cooked so that the devices would not explode. So they said it was kind of a safe mechanism. But you have to ask yourself, would these three, what everyone seems to say was naive young people, passionate about the environment, but pretty naive about the rest of it, would they have picked up a car, driven across the country, rented out a cabin, got hold of bomb recipes, and then planned to carry out these acts if Anna hadn't been in the center of their group?
And to reiterate, I mean, what exactly did they do? I mean, what were they convicted of?
In the end, they did nothing, because they were arrested by the FBI before anything had ever happened. Nothing happened. There had been plans to try and put a bomb at a dam. They thought that by doing that, they would flood an area and sort of be an anti-dam demonstration. But the bomb that they were planning to use was so tiny, it wouldn't have left a dent in the dam. They also were alleged to have planned to attack some sort of science labs related to the genetic modification of trees and tree products. So there were plans around. What we don't know precisely is who came up with those plans in the first place and how much Anna was proactive, which, as I said earlier, is illegal for an infiltrator to be proactive, to lead the group. What we don't know is how much she led the group into planning those acts, which were then never carried out.
I mean, how did we go through a trial, Ed, where one guy gets sent away for 19 years? Like we said, has served 9 of those. How do we go through a trial convicting someone of something that they supposedly planned to do or have conspired to do, and not know who came up with the plan when they have literally, like you say, like hours upon hours upon hours upon hours of video and audio documentation, and apparently they had emails. I mean, it seems like they had every single element of these principles, means of communication, and it was never made explicit who came up with the plan and when?
Well, that's a very pertinent question, and it's why, as you suggested earlier, the judge who recently ordered the release of Eric McDavid had his head in his hands with exasperation, and was expressing astonishment, anger at the prosecution that they had withheld from the defense for all these years evidence that was clearly, absolutely exculpatory, that if the defense had had those documents at the time of the trial, would have put a very, very serious hole in the prosecution case. Not least the fact, which was also only revealed to the defense just a few months ago, that the FBI had requested a lie detector test for Anna. And that was never, they then canceled the test before it was carried out. But the fact that they wanted to do a polygraph with her in order to, quote unquote, in the document, prove her veracity, suggested that even the FBI had a huge doubt about her at the time when she was actively working as an infiltrator within this group. So, you know, had the defense had that information, just that alone, they would have had a field day, let alone all the other email trails that now point towards Anna's role in actively encouraging Eric McDavid in a romantic way.
And we should say, you touched on this, but I want to get specific in terms of the numbers. In 2010, the Justice Department released about 2,500 pages relating to the case under a FOIA Act, a Freedom of Information request, I should say. But it refused to hand over a further 900 pages, you write. I mean, what, you know, this gets into sort of this notion of when we talk about inordinate amounts of secrecy in our government. You have a situation here where nothing happened, right? I mean, obviously, let's just even stipulate that planning happened. We don't know who initiated it, but nothing happened. It involved not even an FBI agent, theoretically, at least on the front lines, right? This person is supposedly right. Just like a super, super concerned citizen.
Well, I think your phrase earlier, hobbyist, is a very good one. She was a hobbyist infiltrator.
And there, I mean, what could possibly be in those 900 pages that would in any way justify them being kept secret from the prosecution? And we should, do you have any sense? Does the Department of Justice say, well, we can't release that because of X or Y? I mean,
the suspicion, the strong suspicion on the part of those who have followed this case closely is that the reason that the prosecution packed up their case pretty quickly and agreed for Eric McDavid to be released, you know, with a very sudden turnaround in style from the prosecution side, was that perhaps they didn't want those 900 pages ever to come out. Now, having allowed Eric McDavid to be released, there is no pressure now and no requirement on the government to let those documents become public. You know, he's out. There's no legal argument why those documents should be seen, other than what I would regard as a very strong public interest argument that the public has a right to know about the way the government may be abusing its own power. But no one is very confident that we'll ever see those 900 pages. And you're right, you have to wonder what's in them. What other secrets does it reveal about the way that the government may have known that things were going wrong with Anna as an infiltrator, providing information back to the government, and yet they still pushed ahead with a very tough prosecution, which, as you said, ended in a sentence of almost two decades.
And to clear up any confusion as to why there won't be any further legal acts or activity around this, is that McDavid is released. But I was shocked when I juxtaposed the reaction by the judge, who apparently was, like you say, I mean, intensely exasperated by what he saw. I mean, at one point he says, like, this is, I can't believe this. McDavid was not exonerated. He simply took basically what strikes me as a not terribly good plea deal. I mean, what is his situation now?
Well, as is so often the case in these sorts of situations, he was offered a plea bargain, and the terms of the plea bargain is, take the deal, you can walk out of jail now, today, but you'll have hanging over you a serious conspiracy offense with attached to it a terrorism order attached to that. Or you can sit it out and try and challenge what we're doing, and you may end up staying in jail for another 3 or 4 years. And, you know, you'd have to be a very, very strong person to face another 3 or 4 years in federal prison rather than take that kind of deal. But, of course, the implications for McDavid are quite serious. If you've got a serious conviction attached to your name with a terrorism sort of label also attached, then it can make your life difficult in terms of finding another job, finding somewhere to live, and all the rest of it. So, and it means that he can't now seek compensation for the 9 years he's done in prison, and he can't seek to clear his name. And that's the classic plea bargain that happens to people every day of the year around America, you know, usually on much smaller charges, but in this case, pretty serious.
But in this instance, too, we should say that the leverage the government had was not simply the threat of jail time, but rather, I mean, you're in a different position, right? I mean, if you're sitting in jail while you're doing this, as opposed to, like, I'm going to go forward with a case. I mean, so this seems to me to be just a horrible, horrible abuse. Now, you do mention in your piece, you mention in your piece that one of the other defendants who did strike a plea deal at the time, Lauren Wiener, who I think ended up serving 2 weeks, maybe it was, this being almost 10 years ago, her attorney is considering legal action to have her federal conviction lifted. And in that instance, it may provide some form of, I guess, of discovery or compel the government to release those other documents. Is that, I mean, what is the chances of that happening?
Well, I think the chance of either thing happening is pretty slim, that either he'll get more of these documents released or that he'll get her conviction removed, particularly as in her case it's done and dusted for so many years. But he's going to draw on the new documents that have come out to make the argument that there was prosecutorial malconduct in this case, and that the same thing applied to her. You know, we talked about how Anna, the new emails show that Anna encouraged Eric McDavid in a romantic sense. Well, they also show that Anna encouraged Lauren as a friend, it wasn't sexual, it was as a friendship, but really, really became incredibly close to Lauren and was sort of actively engaged in Lauren's emotional well-being. Again, Lauren was a naive, young, and it seems emotionally slightly unstable person, and Anna was getting right in there and being her best friend, and who knows, then luring her on again into doing acts that she would not normally have done. So there's definitely a case to be made. Whether it's successful, I think it's going to be quite a long shot.
Is there any chance that in the event that those other 900 pages became public, that based upon what is in those documents, McDavid may have another opportunity to revisit all this? Or is that basically it? He's done. He is a convicted terrorist for the rest of his life.
I think, again, he could have a crack at trying to clear the conviction. But by the time it's done and you've been released and you've signed the plea deal, it's the odds of being successful are very slim. I mean, but the other way to look at it, perhaps, is, as we said, we don't know what's in these 900 pages. The government has said, quite specifically, that they haven't released them because there's nothing in them of interest to the public or to the lawyers of these people. There's nothing that would speak to their defense or their of an exculpatory nature. To which one has to ask an obvious question, which is, over these last 9 years, they've proven to have lied, is one way of putting it, or at least not told the truth, or have withheld crucial information from the defense, which is against the U.S. Constitution. So how come we're now expected to believe them today when the past record is so bad in this case? And I think in a wider sense, it's important to say that what was happening at this time in the early 2000s to the eco movement, the sort of proto-Occupy movement of anarchist and splinter groups, is very, very much today happening to Muslim communities. Exactly the same techniques of infiltration, potentially of leadership, of unlawful, luring people to do things that they would not normally do, is happening time and time again with terror suspects and ending up with exactly the same result, which is that people ending up with long prison sentences where the defense has been withheld crucial evidence that might show that they were wrongfully led into terrorist acts.
And I would also argue that, I mean, we don't know how much of this is going on. I mean, continues, whether it's the environmental movement. I mean, you know, around this time, I remember reports of the FBI surveilling, you know, radical vegans, according to them. And, you know, that's what I find so stunning about this, because, of course, you know, I've seen you've done some great reporting on this story. I've seen this story picked up in a couple of places here or there. But, you know, this plays into a lot of the issues of what the FBI has been doing for an extended period of time and sort of creating these so-called terror threats and then covering their collective derrières, if you will, by not releasing documents because they're so irrelevant to if the government has not ever released documents because of their irrelevancy. It's ludicrous. Let me ask you this. To your knowledge, has this case spurred any other wider attempts at reform? Are there any political leaders who are out there saying, hey, maybe we should look into this? Is this going to be, or is it that this is basically it? If that co-defendant at the time, if their case doesn't move forward, nobody's going to say another peep about this.
Well, I think it's in the nature of this stuff. We're talking about people who are marginalized, who have their backs against the wall, whether or not they're eco-protesters or Muslim community leaders. They have their backs against the wall. There is a sort of social panic going on. People are very concerned about possible terror attacks. Politicians are very wary about, you know, doing anything that might get them criticized in such a heated environment. So the answer in short is no. I mean, I don't think anyone is particularly concerned about this, other than the very courageous, hardworking individual lawyers who are really putting themselves out to try and defend and try and get exonerated some of these people. And that's where the fight lies within the courts. But as ever, you know, these are just a small bunch of lawyers fighting a much bigger story. And unless politicians and, you know, newspapers and the public in general get concerned about what's happening, then I don't think much will change really in this area.
Well, Ed Pilkington, chief reporter for The Guardian U.S., thanks so much for your time today walking us through this.
Thank you, Sam.
And I'll remind people, if you want to hear more on the Earth Liberation Front and their involvement with the FBI over the years, it was the Monday, it was the September 19th, 2011 episode of the Majority Report where we interviewed Marshall Curry, the director of If a Tree Falls. Ed, thanks again.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report.
Here with Matt Binder.
You're here with yourself. It's very existential.
Well, I was giving you the recommendation to add me.
I was. Well, I actually was. I was just waiting for you to jump in.
But anyway, that was incredible stuff. I mean, you know, what is it about, you know, environmental activists that it seems like the FBI always seems to target them? And it is weird to me.
Well, I mean, in that case, that's just and then there was the case out of Britain where they had a guy going undercover who I basically got a woman pregnant and kind of I think even maybe even married her under completely false pretenses. I mean, this sort of abuse of these environmental organizations, and even in some cases, if they're doing something that's illegal, it's definitely not aimed at harming people. It's not aimed, you know, it's aimed at property, and you can debate that one way or another.
Which is interesting to see what they view as a threat.
What they view,
you know,
as a threat
to people, not as important as a threat to property.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and then when you look at the other stuff that people have written about the poultry industry and other parts of the factory farm industry that just by nature of their production, engage in incredible animal abuse and environmental degradation, basically trying to make it illegal to do undercover investigations and film and expose those conditions.
Well, you have to remember that in legal terms and in the actual opinion of many people, sadly, animals are just property, man.
Well, but
they're not living things.
But it's
property.
A whole other issue to actually say that to basically say an act of investigative journalism would be illegal too. So there's a whole continuum of these ways in which environmental activists across the board, from more radical ones to more mainstream ones, are just targeted and marginalized. And you're absolutely right about the legal point too. Okay, folks, we're going to go to the fun half of the program. We have a lot more for you.
646-257-3920, or you can download the app at majorityapp.com and just click the phone call button there, or you can just IM us from the app too. That's majorityapp.com. It's free. No reason why you shouldn't have it. And with that app and with that phone number, 646-257-3920, you can interact with this show and hear your voice. Or hear us read your IMs. Amazing.
And we do read your IMs. We read all of them.
Although if you're going to send us the paragraph long email,
you're sending us like, hey guys, I have a thought of how we could reinvent politics for the 21st century.
Here's my 10-page opinion, which is actually the first 10 pages of a 200-page email.
Here's an excerpt of my doctoral thesis. No. We love that stuff too. Just send that to us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. But we will see you in the fun half of the program.